My last guest this week, certainly not least, is Paul Dell'Aquila, president of Defiance ETFs, who currently offers four ETFs, nearly $800 million in assets, including their most recently launched ETF, which this has generated quite a bit of buzz, the Defiance Next Gen SPAC-derived ETF, ticker symbol SPAK, SPAC. This is the first SPAC ETF on the market. And Paul is now joining me via phone from just outside Philadelphia. Paul, welcome back to the podcast.
Good morning, Nate. Thank you for having me back on the show.
All right. So no question, SPACs have definitely been one of the hottest investment topics this year. I thought what we might do is let's start with some basics, and then I have a bunch of other questions on the ETF and the investment case for SPACs. So for people unfamiliar, what is a SPAC?
So oftentimes what you'll hear them refer to as are blank check companies. But a SPAC, the acronym is actually Special Purpose Acquisition Companies, blank checks. So essentially their sole purpose as a business is to essentially raise capital and then find a private company and bring it to the public markets. So it's an alternative for companies that want to go public to the traditional IPO process.
And can you talk about the process of how a SPAC actually raises money itself?
Yes. Oftentimes, it's an investor, so a single investor or groups of investors who have a particular expertise. So it's not just about pooling assets. It is bringing something to the table from an expertise perspective. So oftentimes, you'll see SPACs that focus on certain areas, like energy. There's sports SPACs. There's a lot of different nuances to it as far as what they focus on. So they actually pull together capital, and then essentially they have 18 to 24 months typically to be able to find a target acquisition of a private entity that they have to bring public to the public market.
And just to be clear, in terms of how the SPAC pulls together that money, the SPAC itself actually has what I would call an IPO, correct? To raise the proceeds. And then as I understand it, those proceeds are placed in a trust account that can only be accessible to fund whatever business they end up acquiring, right? Or I guess redeem individual shareholders if that deal doesn't come to fruition. Is that correct?
That's exactly right. And that's where the blank check comes from. They are essentially money markets, for lack of a better way to say it. They hold that cash. If no target acquisition is found, the SPAC will then delist, and all those proceeds are sent back to the original shareholders from the delisting.
And is there a time frame on that, when the funds have to be used?
Typically, it's 24 months. So that's what you'll see for most. Some are a little bit longer, some are a little bit less. Each SPAC is different, and something I would encourage people to do, if you're thinking about investing in specific SPACs, so just one-off SPACs, they all have publicly websites, so you can go and do your own research. But every nuance to a SPAC, they have a prospectus, they have all the same things that you would be getting from any other investment. Mm-hmm. So if you wanted to do individual due diligence, you have the opportunity to do so.
And then why is this attractive from the perspective of the business actually being acquired? Like, why would they go the SPAC route versus just raising capital via a traditional IPO?
Sure. And so there are some, to that question, there's some specific challenges in 2020 that I can mention, but just at a kind of a bigger picture, why SPACs are becoming of interest, and a greater interest, I should say, is that, A, the traditional IPO process can be a little bit arduous, and in the sense of you have to go out and do these basically road shows to go out and raise capital. So an entity may set out and say, we want to raise $10 billion as part of our IPO process, but if they only raise $5 billion, then they're left with this conundrum. Do they pull back and stay private? Do they actually go forward with less capital than what they anticipated? So in other words, they have to go through that process. What's made it more of a challenge in 2020 is that traveling restrictions in this COVID world have made that a little bit more of a tedious process. So it's a little bit more challenging. The other aspect from a private entity, if you find a SPAC, a partnership that is right for you, it's much easier just to deal with one set of investors. You don't have to pull together a bunch of people to be able to raise that money. You can go to one SPAC. You can access the capital. So it's typically a much quicker process to get to the public markets. The other specific thing you get there from that SPAC typically is that expertise that we were talking about a few minutes ago. So that investor, that group of investors typically is bringing something to the table other than just capital.
You mentioned the impact of the coronavirus pandemic, obviously, on these road shows for companies wanting to IPO. Is that one of the primary drivers behind why the number of SPACs have spiked this year? Because you look at all the data. I mean, they've blown away their previous records in terms of amount raised. Is that the primary driver, or are there other drivers?
I think there's some other drivers there. And just so listeners understand, so SPACs are not necessarily new. And a name that we all know, Burger King, actually used a SPAC to go IPO in 2012. So they've been around for a while. They have gotten a ton of interest, as you said, you know, well over $60 billion so far in 2020 has been raised. So I think there's the answer of COVID, but their other answer is you're seeing much more credited investors step into the arena as far as issuing SPACs. So I think they're seeing it as a very attractive opportunity to be able to find these private entities and use this as a tool to ultimately earn returns for themselves and investors. So I think you're seeing a lot more interest from just an institutional approach that more significant investors are getting into the SPAC game, if you will. And that is definitely increasing the overall pool of assets that are available to private companies now.
Okay, so that's perfect. I mean, on that note, can you talk about the importance of the SPAC management team? Because to me, it seems like investing in a SPAC is essentially betting on that management team, right? That they're going to be able to go out and find an attractive deal.
Very much so. And so there's, if you think about the scope of a SPAC, and I'll use an analogy that has some similarities, definitely some differences, but it's much like a private equity type investment. From, you don't necessarily know what you're going to get when you invest originally in that SPAC. The target, again, 2 years window to lock up that deal, but you don't ultimately know what company they're going to purchase. You're also trusting that they're able to get a deal done, as you said. So there is a tremendous amount of trust. And why I liken it to a private equity investment, you're going to say, all right, this private equity team, this management team, they're going to be able to find deals in the private markets. I trust them. And they're going to be able to get a deal done and show me a return in, you know, 5 years, 7 years, whatever that lockup period is for that investment. So that's where they differ. You know, SPAC has liquidity in the secondary market where you can, you know, get out if you decide you don't want to be part of that investment, or if you don't like the deal that's going to be acquired, you have that optionality. Private equity has a little bit more of a lockup period, but you're exactly right in referencing the management team in both of those entities is extremely important in adding value to the investment being made by those investors.
What does that management team's compensation structure typically look like? Because I know that's a factor here as well.
Yeah, so they all have issues of warrants and they have upside deals. So, you know, essentially they're going to be pulled together much like you would in a private equity type of deal. And they have an upside value once they actually make the target acquisition. So it's an optionality type of arrangement where once a deal is done, they get an accretion to their share price. And the nice thing about this is a little bit different than some other types of investments in this. Individual shareholders get to participate as well. So if you think about private equity, it's a very closed off ecosystem. Even the traditional IPO process is a very closed off ecosystem. If you're not a credit investor, if you're not an underwriter, you're not a big institution, you're not going to get a lot of the best deals. In a SPAC, it sort of democratizes that investment, where institutional investors, yes, they might be first in the sense that they're pulling the capital together, but once they IPO, other investors get to climb into the boat with them and share on that upside return. And I think that's part of the appeal from a SPAC investment, from an individual investor or financial advisor standpoint.
Okay, so with all of that as a backdrop, let's get to the ETF. Again, the Defiance Next Gen SPAC-derived ETF. I'll just hand this over to you. Explain the investment process and what this holds.
Sure. So as the name suggests, it's a SPAC-derived ETF. So what we are offering up investors are the actual pre-IPO SPACs. So those SPACs that are listed, publicly traded, but yet to find an actual deal or a partner from the private markets to bring public. So we have SPACs in there. We also have the companies that have been derived from a SPAC. In other words, IPO'd through a SPAC. So big name that everyone's familiar with for the most part, if you are into football, fantasy sports, anything like that, is DraftKings. So if you've derived from a SPAC, we have an allocation there as well. So you get the upside participation, hopefully, from the IPO, and you also get the hopeful participation in those SPACs that have yet to do a deal and that accretion in the price that happens once a deal is announced.
From an investor standpoint, Can you talk a little bit about the overall risk return profile here and maybe what the longer term investment case is?
Sure. And the way we've seen interest from financial advisors is much more in this alternative type of bucket, right? So if you think about an asset allocation, you're going to have your large cap core, value growth, all that kind of good stuff. If you look at Morningstar, we're actually classified as a small cap growth ETF. So I think that makes sense, just, you know, fundamentally speaking. But the way we see advisors having interest in this fund is more in the alternative bucket. So in other words, instead of using a private equity, they might look to something like this. So the risk return profile has a similar characteristic. They're going to be winners and losers here, right? Mm-hmm. They're going to be SPACs that have do a great job. They perform, they find a good target, and they show returns. Same thing with the post-IPOs. You're seeing something like a DraftKings. Despite some recent volatility, it's had a monster year from a return standpoint. So that's a good thing for investors. Not every one of the SPACs, not every post-IPO company is going to perform that way. So I think the ETF structure makes sense because you're going to have diversification across a number of these investments. And when they win, they tend to win big. And if they lose, you know, you have diversification. You don't have all your eggs in one basket. And much like I referenced earlier, if you're going to bet on an individual SPAC, you're tied up on one deal, you're tied up on one management team. With an ETF, we have the same characteristics we do with every other equity or fixed income ETF. You have diversity, and not all your eggs are in one basket.
How quickly are new SPACs or I guess SPAC-derived companies added to the ETF? And conversely, I mean, what if there is a problematic SPAC that needs to be removed? How quickly does that happen?
Sure. So we have a monthly review process because it is a dynamic space, right? So there's constantly... Every day, SPACs are being added to the market. In a sense, new ones are IPOing. Same thing with merger deals that are happening. So we have a monthly review process. We do look at everything on a quarterly basis as well. So any reconstitution, in other words, removals or anything like that, happens on a quarterly basis. But every month, we're actually looking at SPACs and also those post-IPO SPACs that may have merged with a SPAC that we don't actually own. If we own the SPAC in the ETF and it merges with another company, simply the ticker symbol changes, the new entity is owned by the ETF already, and all shareholders will own representation of that new entity, whatever it becomes, once the merger is complete.
One thing I'm curious about is, I'm sure you're aware, there are a handful of ETFs offering exposure to recent IPOs, so-called IPO ETFs. How similar are those to SPAC?
So the basic concept is there's a lot of similarity there. And what we're trying to do is be representative of the SPAC market. So in other words, you know, the big unicorns right now that everyone's talking about from an IPO process, Airbnb, you know, DoorDash, for instance, a lot of them are right now, those two in particular, are looking more towards a traditional IPO process. So they would be part of an IPO ETF. They would not be part of ours because what we're trying to do is fundamentally make sure that we're capturing the SPAC market through those SPACs that are listed and not yet defined a target and those post-IPO SPACs. So we have a little bit more specificity. But you are correct. The basic concept is you want to constantly have a refresh of new holdings in the sense that none of these holdings are going to be owned, you know, infinitely. You're going to have a constant changing of what's at the top. And it gives you, as an investor, a way to play some of these hot up-and-coming companies. And you can think about a lot of them that have IPO'd recently, you know, the Pelotons of the world that investors have a lot of interest in and have been, you know, especially in the era that we're in right now as far as COVID, we're seeing a lot of interest, a lot of return potential in some of these names. So it gives you a diversity across some of these hotter IPO names. Ours is focused specifically on the SPAC marketplace.
About a minute left here. On a similar note, obviously the ETF space is highly competitive, right? It's not called the Terror Dome for nothing.
Yeah.
And there are at least two other SPAC ETFs in the hopper that I'm aware of that have been filed with the SEC. The question I have for you is, how big do you think this segment of the ETF market can be?
I think the beauty of where we are right now, I've been in ETFs for 20 years. The one thing I know is, especially with the success we've had with SPAC early on, if you have a successful ETF, it won't be long before others come into the game. So I think that's good. It says there's more credibility to the space. You know, other participants are coming in. To answer your question, how big can it get? I think the nice thing is we're still in the early innings as far as the interest of what the SPAC market can be. So it's going to mature for sure, and so will the ETFs, I think, that are coming out, and, you know, ours as well. But I think the potential can be very big, especially with what you're seeing this year. Like I said, $60 billion of issuance of new SPACs. They're all looking for targets. I think you're going to ultimately find, like I said, the winner and loser situation playing out a lot more. Let's face it, you know, $60 billion in assets, that's a lot of money. Does that mean every private company is going to get a SPAC to be able to partner with to go public? You know, I think the list is going to continue to get longer. So the ultimate cream of the, you know, the kind of those creme de la creme of companies that are really those top performers, there's going to be more of a selective process that has to happen for the SPACs. They've got to be very careful with who they're partnering up with, what companies are going to bring brought from the private to the public markets. And so the space will grow, but I think that is more of the onus on the ETFs to make sure they're selecting the best SPACs out there, the ones with the most liquidity, some of the bigger asset pools. They're going to be able to get the best deals done, because there is going to have to be a selection process to make sure you're not just getting a bunch of watered down companies that are just looking for targets because, you know, they just have a blank check and they're looking to make an acquisition.
Well, Paul, congratulations on the launch. You were first here with the first SPAC ETF, which I always tip my hat to. Certainly wish you all the success. Thank you for joining me this week.
It's my pleasure, Nate. Thank you again for having me on the show.
That was Paul Dell'Aquila, president of Defiance ETFs.